And so the beginning of the brainstorming process is throwing ideas out and logging them, getting everybody's ideas. You don't know where the ideas are going to come from. In an organization, this is something I learned from the laboratory. In an organization, it's very important to separate the ideas from the people who hold them. That separation is important because you want to be able to criticize the ideas without having the people feel that they are being criticized. And so there's a sort of objective distance that is optimal where someone can bring an idea into play, but then allow it to be criticized or maybe even criticize it themselves.
I'm Srini Rao, and this is the Unmistakable Creative Podcast, where you get a window into the stories and insights of the most innovative and creative minds who've started movements, built thriving businesses, written best-selling books, and created insanely interesting art. For more, check out our 500-episode archive at unmistakablecreative.com. Adam, welcome to the Unmistakable Creative. Thanks so much for taking the time to join us.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, so I actually came across you by way of my publisher who sent me your book, The Right Kind of Crazy. And with a title like that, I couldn't resist. And not only that, when they told me what you actually do for a living, I thought, yeah, we have to talk to this guy. He's probably got a lot of really interesting and amazing stories. So rather than give it away for our listeners, can you tell us a bit about yourself, your story, your journey, your background, and how it has led to The Right Kind of Crazy?
Sure. I work now. Spoiler alert, I work at NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory, but my path to NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory is not a standard one or perhaps represents the diversity of possible paths that one might follow in one's life. I was not a very good student, sort of raised by art-appreciating folks, and was attracted to the arts and theater, and out of high school, did very poorly in high school, was playing rock and roll, was wanting to be a rock star. No teenagers or early kids want to do that. And playing gigs around the San Francisco Bay Area. And one night, as I went home from playing a show, I noticed the stars were in a different place in the night sky than they had been when I went out. This was amazingly the first time I'd really paid attention to the stars. And it ended up being the constellation of Orion, but I didn't know it at the time. And it was on the other side of the bay when I was coming home. I had clearly dropped the whole Earth spinning on its axis thing that you learn in school from my consciousness. And I was curious. I was curious about why the stars were moving. And I was at a point in my life where I was willing to follow that curiosity and see where it would take me. First, it took me down to the local community college, College of Marin, and I tried to sign up for an astronomy course to teach me why the stars were moving. And it had with it a prerequisite of a physics course, but a conceptual physics course, physics without math. So I signed up for that physics class, and boom, kind of the rest is history. It blew my mind. The idea that the world was governed by a set of laws that were relatively simple and elegant and beautiful, and that you could understand them, and that you could use them to predict the way that the physical universe would work, just turned me on, and I wanted to learn. And so I started with refreshing or replacing my deficient high school education, and went up through eventually a PhD in engineering physics. And I work at JPL, and I land spacecraft on other planets.
All right. So there's a lot of really interesting stuff here that I want to dig back into. I mean, you mentioned that you weren't a good student in high school and that you grew up around parents who were artistic types. One, I'd like to hear about that in more depth. I mean, even before high school and realizing, because I know that you mentioned in the book that you almost even dropped out of high school and didn't do well at all. I'm just curious, I mean, what that whole experience was like. And then, of course, how did the experience of having sort of this exposure to the arts and this interest in music and all those things, end up shaping your perspective on the work that you did later on?
Well, so I was raised, you know, my family was, my parents were brilliant, beautiful people who I love very much, but they were, you know, they were not, I don't think that they were, certainly my father was not fulfilled. He was an alcoholic for most of the time that I was growing up. He didn't work. He was the, inherited some money from family wealth, not really enough to do much with, or he didn't do much with it except for sort of spend it. But that meant that they read, we traveled. My mother, who was sort of the antithesis of my dad, she was sort of a self-made woman. She had lied about her age at 17 to join the U.S. Army and learn to fly aircraft to shuttle bombers around during World War II. So she was a very independent-minded woman, very creative, architect, very mechanically gifted. My father actually was really a native engineer, but he also, you know, designed jewelry and was into photography, you know, you name it. But so we traveled. We would see all the museums wherever we went. But we didn't work hard. Nobody really worked hard at anything. No one faced the edges of what they might be able to do. No one really, especially my father, risked much. And so and in the same breath, my parents, certainly my father, really wanted my brother, and I have a younger brother, Peter, who ended up is really an artist, lives in France. But he wanted us to do well. My dad wanted us to do, to sort of, he used to say, I want some performance out of you, damn it. Which I used to think of like asking for a seal to clap their hands or something. But so I rebelled against that. I rebelled against his pressure. I rebelled against, you know, maybe I thought actually trying was scary because it was somehow too scary for my dad to really, really do. And so we just were bad students, my brother and I both. And my parents didn't confront us with it. I mean, it's kind of amazing. You know, in high school, one day I was late for my Latin class, and the teacher was a particularly nasty man who would lambaste students when they spoke out in class, and certainly if they ever came late. And so I paced out in front of the door, waiting to go in, trying to get up my courage. And I paced long enough that the end of the period came and the bell rang, and I went to my next class. And all through my next class, I was scared that the police were going to arrive or somebody was going to show and bust me for missing class. And nothing happened. And so the next Latin class, I did it again. And then I did it with my English class, and so on and so forth. And eventually I stopped going to class altogether and kind of waiting to see what would happen. A couple, 3 weeks went by, and my parents said, hey, we got a note from school that you aren't going to class. What's up? Their response wasn't very strong, and I kind of stayed with it. So my sophomore and junior years in high school, I really didn't go to class much at all. And they never really confronted it. So anyway, the short of it is, I had this kind of amorphous childhood. I think I was sort of searching for structure, searching for boundaries, trying to come up against something solid, and I didn't. And I broke a lot of bones, risking stuff, doing daredevil stuff, looking for those boundaries. And I, you know, missed a lot of class hours. And it was, you know, as I mentioned, it wasn't until I could do it on my own, follow my own curiosity, that I was willing to put in the effort, put in the risk, mm-hmm. and see what would happen.
You said something in there that really caught my attention. It was the idea of going to the edges of what you might be able to do. And I'm wondering, based on the perspective that you have had literally landing spacecrafts on the moon, what you think it is that enables human beings to go to the edges of what they're able to do, and what is it that keeps certain people from doing it?
Well, I do think fear. So first question first, that is, I don't have a good short answer for you about what enables human beings to search for the edge of what is us, what can we do. But I absolutely believe that that is the right kind of crazy. We are very unusual creatures if in comparison to all the other beasts on this planet. And when you look at our behavior, one of the hallmarks of our humanity is this exploration. And that exploration is asking the question, what's over the next ridge? Can I get over the next ridge? How strong am I? How grand am I? What questions might I ask and hope to answer? So that's a real, that curious stretching out to see what is possible is very, very essentially human. And what holds us back from it is fear. Is fear that we will fail, fear that we won't measure up. It's certainly what held my father back. Yeah. And I think actually it is in opposition to that model or lesson that he demonstrated for me that I push extra hard. I'm actually very willing. And I think it's a generic good thing to be willing to find myself wrong as I search for what is right and true, you know. So I'm willing to take risks. I am attracted to, even in my work, right? There's lots of aerospace engineers out there. There's lots of aerospace engineering projects to work on. But I'm attracted to the ones that are a little bit more risky, that are a little bit less certain. Mm-hmm. I'm attracted to the less certain problems, the problems that don't have a pat answer. Because the thing that I want to make sure is that I don't stop short of trying for fear of failing. So I'm willing to step out there and take the risk. And I think many people are. All the people I work with are. Hundreds of my colleagues are willing to take that risk. And so, but those who aren't are, I think, thwarted because they fear that they will their fear of judgment, their own judgment, really, in the end, their own criticism, fear that they won't measure up. Geez, I understand that. I'm scared to death. I wrote a book. Boy, that's a scary process, putting your thoughts out there. So it's the fear of failing. It's the fear of not measuring up really to your own expectation that I think holds people back. But in general, as a species, it doesn't hold us back. And that's why I'm Skyping with you over the interweb. I mean, my dogs can't Skype. The squirrels don't Skype. Mm-hmm. TCIP did not, you know, TCIP exists because of our crazy, stretching out, curious brains. And so I'm just being a human.
So you're continually put in situations where the fear of being wrong, and more importantly, the consequences of being wrong, are quite severe. And I'm wondering how, and more importantly, what are the lessons in managing fear that you've brought from that into your life in general, and what people might be able to take away from that?
That's a great, great question. The searching out of the idea, of the concept, of something new or what the truth is. I can remember even as a student doing this, requires for me, at least my personal practice, is to be comfortable with the open question and be quiet and not fearful that I'll get it wrong, not judgmental of how I'm groping for the solution, but just going for it. The image I have is reaching into the darkness with my hand and sort of feeling around for the solution. After that process, when you've dragged something out of the darkness and into the light, you've got to do a very different thing. You take a different part of your brain or your organization and you analyze it. You decompose it. you bring outside eyeballs that are ignorant to the things that drew you to that solution to look at and criticize it. And it's through that analysis process that you begin to understand whether that idea, that creative impulse was a good one or not. Was it the right kind of crazy or the wrong kind of crazy? And so there's really two pieces to it, and they're sort of complementary and different. One is the opening of the question and the looking for the solution in that openness. And that's a non-judgment part. That's a no rules, no judgment. And only once the idea is out, either written down on paper or sketched on a whiteboard or drawn out through conversation with somebody else, then this analysis part comes. And you know, what we do at the lab, at the JET Proposal Lab where I work, is we use external review, which is not uncommon in aerospace and engineering firms, but we bring outside eyeballs in to look at our work, people who aren't experts. Maybe they're experts in a field that's adjacent or even similar, but they're certainly not experts in the design that we're putting forward. And so to that extent, they bring kind of a beginner's mind to it, and they can criticize and see the inventions that we're working on in sort of a stark light, and maybe perceive something differently than we did, the ones who sort of dreamed it up.
So I want to talk briefly about that moment of curiosity when you looked up in the stars. And I wonder why so many people neglect or don't do anything in moments like that, or even just miss moments like that in their lives. And the other question that is a byproduct of that, of course, is, I mean, going from a high school dropout to a Caltech PhD working at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory, landing aircrafts on other planets or spacecrafts on other planets, that's a pretty drastic shift in identity. And I'm wondering what happens internally and how that's possible. And how do we enable that kind of change in our own lives?
Okay, those are two fantastic questions. Let me take the first one first. So for all of the, you know, dysfunction of my upbringing, for all of the classic and obvious dysfunction of my family growing up, and, you know, my dad would be drinking the sunrise to sunset, they absolutely instilled in me a curiosity and an appreciation for what curiosity can do. I think their dysfunction meant I couldn't connect up with it until I was much later in life. And maybe that was even perfect, because maybe in that sense, I was coiled and in anticipation until I had the tools and the horsepower to really push forth and follow my curiosity. I don't know. But I think that what limits people from following their curiosity is, again, fear of change. You know, we fear of failure, but also fear of just the change that the question, asking a question, changes things. The answer changes our understanding of the universe. It may frequently in very, very small ways, like if I were to check on my telephone what the temperature outside was, and I were to find it was a little cooler than I thought it was, that might change my opinion of the day, even though I'm looking out on a beautiful, beautiful sunny day. So those kinds of changes aren't very much, but some changes that a question can bring, it can be profound and really watershed. So it is, again, this, I think fear of change, and it snowballs. You know, it snowballs in both ways. If you're willing to ask the question, it's the ultimate vote of self-confidence, because you say, hey, world, I'm going to open up this question and I'm going to, I'm confident that I can handle whatever change, whatever the truth that is discovered through opening that question and answering it, that I can handle that. It's a very, I think, powerful vote of self-confidence, and it allows you to ask another question and another one and another one. And I know people who don't do that, and in fact, who hate the open question and don't want to think about stuff. And each time they turn away from that question, it's a vote of no self-confidence. I don't have it in me to look into the unknown, to discover something new, and to process and move on with my life in light of that new knowledge. And so it's a constant act of turning away. It's a very sad thing. But so there you go. That's question number one. Slightly rambling. I hope it's acceptable. Mm-hmm. What was your second question?
The identity shift.
From
being somebody who nearly flunks out of high school to being a Caltech PhD and landing spacecrafts on the moon. I mean, that's a pretty drastic change.
Right. So, yes. So there is a big identity shift. So I live in Southern California, and I was raised in Northern California in Marin County. Super liberal. And I, dyed in the wool, deep hippie in some ways, but I just adore Southern California because in the desert, let me back up. Southern California is frequently criticized by people in Northern California for being, empty, culturally empty, even though the culture, it massively influences the culture of the world. It's criticized, at least when I was growing up in Northern California, for being culturally empty, just filled with superficiality. And it's in a desert. The desert's not really filled with life. Well, I love that. I love that cultural desert. And to some extent, that's true. I wouldn't say just like the real desert, which I love to go out into. The real desert is actually filled with life if you know where to look for it and you know how to listen for it. Same thing is true in Los Angeles and Southern California. But it is true that Southern California has a culture that is fractured enough that you can rewrite or write yourself again in any form down here. So, circling back to your question, the identity shift was big. And part of it, not only was there a shift from being an artsy person interested in the arts to being interested in the sciences and engineering, there was a shift into doing. My parents had just thought about stuff and sat around thinking about stuff, and I wanted to do stuff. There was a shift from Northern California to Southern California. There was an ability to let go of some of the things in my past. There was a transformation that Southern California was part of because I was free from for all the purported tolerance of Northern California, it's not really widely tolerant of very diverse views, in my opinion. And I was in touch with that, what I consider to be hypocrisy. And since I'm a dyed-in-the-wool liberal, I'm most critical of those who share the beliefs most closely aligned with my own. And so coming down to Southern California allowed me to be my own person and to find myself on my own terms. And that was very much part of an identity shift that happened with this whole transformation. I had to turn.
You think that everybody is capable of those kinds of identity shifts?
I guess it's really, I find myself talking about risk a lot here. I personally think that there are very few failures that await us in life that are as bad or as debilitating as the fear of them is. Now, there's some things you shouldn't do. Jump out of an airplane without a parachute. or even in a wingsuit or some of that crazy wackadoo stuff. I mean, then you're really rolling the dice, and the failure that awaits you is like crippling or death, you know. So, but within, you know, polite society, there's not a lot of things you can do. There's not a lot of exploration that you can do. There's not a lot of seeking out that you can do. The answers or questions that you can ask, the answers of which are worse for you than the fear of asking the question. And so, but I think many times people don't see that. I think certainly, you know, this is the gift of my father. He was frozen. My dad was brilliant, right? He did furniture, he did photography. He became a leading expert in the artificial insemination of sheep. He studied horticulture in Sussex. They built this beautiful and restored this beautiful hacienda in Mexico, in Sonora, Mexico. And he hand forged all of the hinges and all of the door lock and window mechanisms in the entire place, right? He was an artisan, he was an engineer, but he would never cross the threshold and take that risk of really putting himself, his creativity on the line. And so in a definite move to not want to be my dad, I have chosen repeatedly to do that. And I think that's a great gift from him, that it is that impulse I have to, you know, I love him, he's passed, but I don't bear him any grudges. But I think that his lasting gift for me is the impulse to not be trapped as he was by his fear.
Let's do this. Let's shift gears a little bit.
Okay.
And let's start talking about the process of what goes on to land a spacecraft on the moon, because I think the creative process behind that is probably a lot more complicated than, say, publishing a podcast or putting a book out. And so I want to talk about what that creative process looks like, the framework that this book offers, and how we might start to apply this to our lives, which I realize is a very big question.
Great. Well, at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory where I work, we work in teams. In fact, when I look back at it, I think that most of the great works of humanity, not the great ideas, but the great works, are all accomplished in teams. And so the way we work and the way, for instance, the sky crane was invented was a group of people sitting in a room brainstorming, looking for a solution to a problem that we didn't know how to solve. When we do that, we take on I'm holding in my hands, you can't see it, my two hands making a lesser than and a greater than symbol. The lesser than symbol the lesser than symbol looking like a crescendo symbol in music means this opening process. And so the beginning of the brainstorming process is throwing ideas out and logging them. Getting everybody's ideas. You don't know where the ideas are going to come from. In an organization, this is something I learned from the laboratory. In an organization, it's very important to separate the ideas from the people who hold them. That separation is important because you want to be able to criticize the ideas without having the people feel that they are being criticized. And so there's a sort of objective distance that is optimal, where someone can bring an idea into play, but then allow it to be criticized, or maybe even criticize it themselves. One tool I've used at points in the past is to ask team members to bring ideas into play, but make the three central arguments for the concept and the three central arguments against the concept that they are bringing to the team. This in an effort to establish that objective distance between the idea that you've thought of and yourself, and see it sort of in more three-dimensional, in more three dimensions, or multi-dimensionally, and so see it with its warts and its wrinkles. So the first part is idea generation. And after you've done some time with that, sometimes that will be an hour, sometimes that can be days. But when you feel that sort of you've vented all of the creative juices, at least for the time being, then you go into bringing in the analytical portion of your minds, the other half of the brain, and you go in towards this judgment, beating the ideas against each other, this sort of intellectual competition between ideas, and search for the fittest of the ideas. And sometimes hybrids emerge in this process, and sometimes it's cyclical. Sometimes you unearth through that analysis process another domain, another region to be mined for new ideas, and you pause and you go mine new ideas in this idea generation phase in that new regime, in that new basin of attractions it would be. And then bring back the analytical portions of the process. And so that's how the Sky Crane was born. That's how a lot of the ideas that that have helped the laboratory be successful over the years, they come out of a process that frequently looks like that.
So how do you test assumptions and deal with the possibility of being wrong in situations where the stakes are so high? I mean, this doesn't sound as simple as split testing a web page, where if the consequences are the copy didn't convert, whereas in your case, the consequences are much more severe if you're wrong.
Right. It can be billions of taxpayers' dollars on the line. So there are maybe three tools that are could be available to somebody in our field. They are test, analysis, and external review. And unfortunately for our landing system, when we put the big Curiosity rover on Mars and we landed the 2,000-pound vehicle using the Sky Crane, we didn't have the ability to test. Mars is got a different atmosphere. It's got a different gravity, got a different speed of sound. We cannot do an end-to-end test of our entry system, our entry, descent, and landing system. And so we relied on analysis and external review. And so we did our best to test our assumptions. We built models of how we thought our system should work. We even dabbled in role-playing. Some people would be sort of designated as critics to try and tear down the ideas that we had. And then eventually we needed to turn to external eyeballs, people who are not invested in the solution, and bring them in to look at it, to criticize it, to review it. And then for ourselves to try and be open and listening to that external criticism to see what we wanted to take to heart and what we thought they didn't have right. And so it's deploying those tools, and you have to. You can't, or at least I'm unaware, because in my profession it's all done in teams, I'm unaware of how one could sit by themselves and go through this whole cycle without getting some external perspective sort of driven into the process.
Where have you made really costly mistakes in the process of doing things like this, and what have you learned from those mistakes?
Well, that's a good one. First, of course, you learn the most from your mistakes. Let's see. Let me think of a good example of a costly mistake. Well, we've lost some spacecraft going to Mars. Those have been, in the 90s, when we put a spacecraft called the Mars Pathfinder on the surface of Mars in 1997. And it had been 20 years since we'd been to the surface of Mars. And the first time and last time that we'd been to the surface of Mars had been through the Viking missions, Vikings 1 and 2. And we hadn't been back to the surface of Mars for so long because it was so costly to build one of these big missions. And so in the 90s, the new NASA administrator, Daniel Golden, asked the question, how can we greatly reduce costs of exploration? Can we embrace risk, look to new methods, new ways, less documentation, less protocols, more driving straight towards a solution, acknowledging risk, and explore for greatly reduced costs? And the first mission out of the chute with that was the Pathfinder mission. And it was called Pathfinder, not because we didn't know how to go to Mars, but it was kind of a new way of doing business. And it was successful. We did that mission for about $350 million, which was about one-tenth the cost of the Viking missions. And unfortunately, we didn't stop there. We sort of got a little addicted to the limbo game and asked, how low can you go? And the next missions that followed on were the Mars Polar Lander and the Mars Climate Orbiter. And we tried to do two missions for basically that $350 million or so. And we found that we went too low. The limbo bar was too low. We lost, actually, both of those missions for different reasons. For different specific reasons, but they can all be sort of captured in, we didn't spend enough time and have enough people because we were trying to strip down the team, we were trying to strip down processes, and we stripped them down too far, and we ended up losing both missions. So that was a big blow to the Mars exploration program and, you know, big blow to NASA. And so the big lesson that we learned there is you can't just keep stripping it down. There is a cliff out there, and if you don't have enough people, these external eyes to which I told you about, right? None of us works alone. We're working in teams. We're working with people checking on our work, all trying to catch misses, to find holes in our assumptions, holes in our perception. And we went too low with that, with the Mars Polar Lander and the Mars Climate Orbiter.
You find that failures like that have impacted people's confidence in their own abilities? And if so, how have they recovered from that internal sort of damage that might occur when they experience a failure?
Yeah. It does shake your confidence. It really does. You retrench. You know, what it does is it shows you that you were wrong about something, which is good. It's a great act of humility. I find that I'm wrong about something several times a day. And it's good to keep savvy, keep in your foremind the fact that you can be wrong and it's happened before and it will likely happen again, and try and be cautious and careful about it. But it doesn't mean you're wrong about everything. And so the process, at least my process, has been, okay, I don't know as much as I thought I know or thought I knew. Let me backtrack, and what am I very certain of? And you back away, you sort of go back home in some sense, and you home down into that which you really know to be true, and you work your way and build your way back out from that. And that's what you do. And it's it can, some people are, it's, you know, this exploration of space that we do at JPL and at NASA, it's not for the faint of heart. There is risk involved. You can put an awful lot of your blood, sweat, and tears into something, and it can fail. And that process is not for everybody. And some people respond by just leaving. We lost some good people after some of our failures, and even after some of our successes. When we landed the Mars Exploration Rovers mission, we put two fantastic solar-powered rovers about the size of a coffee table on the surface of Mars in 2004. And one of them is still alive today, outbeating all the odds of longevity. They were only supposed to last 90 days. But I can tell you that some folks from our team, from the landing team, quit after that. They said, you know, this is just too stressful. And they moved away and moved out of space and went to other parts of the country and just took a more peaceful life. So it's not necessarily for everybody. But when you have a failure, when you recognize that you were wrong about something, you start back with what you do know to be true and you build your confidence back up that way. At least that's what I've done. And it's worked for me.
What are the implications of the work that you guys are doing around space exploration for the future of humanity? And how does the work that people like Elon Musk are doing and you know, the kinds of things that we're seeing at places like Singularity University coincide or you know, working in parallel to what you guys are doing? Which I realize is a very, very big question.
Yeah, well, it's huge. It's profound. Well, there are like, yeah, great. There's like five major watersheds of thought in the question you just asked me. I'll start with the easiest. So we're when we explore frequently, we're going out to answer specific science questions. And those questions can be quite they can be trivial, they can be profound. And they can be as profound as, are we alone? You know, are we, is all this life we see teeming all over this planet the only life in our universe? Is it the only life in our solar system? So you can be asking and hoping to answer a science question, and that science question can be as profound as, you know, is there life other places. But there is more when we explore. I think people like Elon are driven to explore for questions that are more profound than, or for reasons that are more profound than just the science questions. When we explore, I think we are also fundamentally acting out our humanity. Exploration is not a particularly practical, or not at least obviously practical, act, but like all the great acts of our species, it is a gesture of who we are. Art, theater, music, architecture, literature, sport, these are not particularly practical pursuits. It doesn't necessarily put more food on the table, necessarily, if I paint a beautiful painting. But we do it nonetheless. We do it because we're driven to do it. We do it because we are these curious beasts searching for the edges of what we might be and be able to do. That is perhaps the most profound reason for us to explore. And there is a practical benefit to it. You know, we have, and many have noted this, George Church, the famous geneticist at Harvard, Elon, I was with Fred Hayes, the Apollo 13 astronaut, a couple weeks ago, and he was mentioning this. You know, being on this planet, we do suffer from some concentration risk, is what they'd call it in risk analysis, field. That is to say, we're all on this single rock together, and an event, an external event, could come along here and wipe us out, wipe all of us out. And so I think some folks look to Mars or other destinations as a way of helping lessen our concentration risk. And that may be true. It certainly is true. I don't know. You know, I think some of the greatest risks that we face on this planet are not external risks, like an asteroid plumbing into us, although that risk is non-zero. There's no doubt about that, and we should be watching for that and prepared to act. But I think the greatest risks that we face here on Earth come from ourselves and our own behavior. And I suspect that the engineering, the care, the discipline needed to make Mars, for instance, a place to live, that would be palatable and tolerable and support life are the same kinds of engineering discipline and care needed to keep Earth a good place to live and protect it from its greatest threat, which I think is our folly. So there are many, many reasons for us to explore. I welcome the presence of the privateers like Bezos and Musk and other privateers who are, you know, privatizing that beautiful expression of our humanity that is the exploration of our universe, including the exploration of space.
Wow. That was incredible. So I have one last question for you, which is how we finish all our interviews. What do you think it is that makes somebody or something unmistakable?
Access to its essence. I think when we, the essential is a very important thing to me, finding the essential, calling out the essential. And when we see the essential, that is unmistakable. That is what, how we know what we are looking at. And sometimes that is clouded in noise and clutter. And so getting through to that is itself essential. So I think what makes something unmistakable is the accessibility of its essence.
Awesome. Well, this has been really, really cool. And I really appreciate you taking the time to join us and share your insights and your story with us, because this, again, was a really, really different perspective on creativity and making things. And I've really, really enjoyed talking to you.
Well, thank you very, very much for having me. I had a good time.
Awesome. And for everybody listening, we will wrap the show with that. Thank you for listening to this episode of the Unmistakable Creative Podcast. While you were listening, were there any moments you found fascinating, inspiring, instructive, maybe even heartwarming? Can you think of anyone, a friend or a family member who would appreciate this moment? If so, take a second and share today's episode with that one person, because good ideas and messages are meant to be shared.